Israel has crumbled under the might of the Assyrian war machine. Seemingly unstoppable, Sennacherib's army has entered Judah to the south and has begun systematically picking off its cities. Panicked, Judah's king Hezekiah calls on his resident holy man for help, the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah is unflustered. Hezekiah's kingdom will not fall to Sennacherib. The Assyrian king will be called away on other business. Meanwhile, the nation is left ruined. But neither Hezekiah nor Sennacherib can possibly imagine what happens next. My name is Chaz Bayfield, and this is Holy Bible Episode 91, The Death Angel. Hello friends, you've found the only Bible podcast on the airwaves that places religion neatly to one side and simply gets on with the story. My mission, if that's not too noble a word, is to share this incredible book with the great unchurched, especially people who appreciate the seismic shockwaves it has created across the centuries, but have never been bold or religious enough to dig in. We do that for you here at Holy Bible, and you're lucky, these are some of the most action-packed pages in the book. Though not the ones that often get aired in churches. Festering boils, mass slaughter, and child sacrifice can be a little too much for a Sunday morning. This podcast, however, leaves no page unturned and lets you decide whether any of it is true or not. Right, let's go to Judah. For the next year, Judah's people will have to make do with what is left in the ground after the Assyrians have ravaged their land, the prophet Isaiah tells his king. The following year is possibly a Sabbath one, which means planting is forbidden. Sabbath years were instituted centuries earlier in the time of Moses and were put in place to give the land a break from farming. During the Sabbath year, everyone needs to make do with whatever is left in the storehouses and whatever grows from the roots that are still in the ground. Only after 2 years is sowing and harvesting allowed as usual. Despite the slaughter and destruction it has suffered, a remnant of Judah will survive, the prophet says, just like the crops out in the field that have taken root below ground and bear fruit when no planting can take place. Isaiah promises that God is determined to rescue what he describes as a band of survivors from Jerusalem. This is a clear sign to Hezekiah that God is on Judah's side and that his nation will enjoy future security. It also provides reassurance that his rebuff of Sennacherib won't have dangerous repercussions for him or his country. Isaiah passes on more comforting words that he believes have come from God. Sennacherib will neither shoot an arrow, build a siege ramp, nor enter the city, and will return the same way he came. According to the prophet, God is personally defending Jerusalem for the sake of David, whose sons have been promised a seat on its throne forever. According to the account in the second book of Kings, God sends his avenging angel into the Assyrian camp that night, and over 180,000 of Sennacherib's soldiers are wiped out. The remainder of the army is withdrawn, and the king returns to his base in Nineveh. As promised by Isaiah in the previous episode, Sennacherib's watch ends badly. He is assassinated by his own sons while worshipping in the temple of a pagan god, Nisroch. In records kept by Sennacherib, which can still be read today, he describes making Hezekiah a prisoner in his royal palace, quote, like a bird in a cage. But for all his crowing, Assyria's king never actually writes about a victory over Jerusalem, suggesting that this particular attack is a failure. The threat from Assyria may have temporarily disappeared, but Hezekiah's ill health soon puts his own future in jeopardy. Judas King is struck down with a fatal illness and is told by Isaiah that he should put his affairs in order as his time is almost up. Understandably a big fan of life, Hezekiah begs God for a bit of extra time. Openly weeping, he reminds God of how faithful and loyal he has been to him. Isaiah has not even left the temple when he receives a message which he believes is from God, telling him that the decision on Hezekiah has been reversed. The king has been granted 15 more years of life. Better still, Hezekiah is told by the prophet that Jerusalem will remain safe from Assyrian attack during his lifetime. Isaiah makes a compress from figs, places it on the festering boil that is threatening Hezekiah's life, and the king recovers. Poultices are still used as a traditional way to treat boils and abscesses. The moist heat can draw out the infection, helping the abscess to shrink and drain naturally. Hezekiah's recovery seems too good to be true, and the king wants a sign to be sure that the 15-year extension is really his. He and Isaiah agree that the sun changing direction so that the shadow on the temple steps retreats rather than advances would be unusual. 3 days later, as promised by Isaiah, the sun's shadow creeps backwards, and Hezekiah knows that he has been spared. Sadly, this only gives Hezekiah extra time to mess up and ruin all the good work that he has put into the monarchy so far. Babylon's king hears about Hezekiah's remarkable recovery from the brink of death and sends envoys to find out more. It's a prime opportunity for the king to eulogise about Judah's God and his miraculous healing powers, but for some unknown reason, Hezekiah decides to show his visitors around Jerusalem's treasure-filled storehouses. Once the men have left, Isaiah is keen to know who they were and what brought them to his palace. On hearing that they were from Babylon, the prophet asks what Hezekiah showed them. Perhaps because he is simply high on being given a new lease of life, the king seems pleased that he was able to show his visitors all his treasures. Isaiah informs the king that this was a terrible faux pas and that all these precious items will now be carried away to Babylon. Worse still, some of the king's own relations will be taken away to that city to become palace eunuchs. Terrible as the news is, Hezekiah is comforted that none of this will take place during his own lifetime, and it would be harsh to see the eventual sacking of Jerusalem as Hezekiah's fault, given how saintly his reign is compared to most of his predecessors. Once his 15 years are up, Hezekiah dies and is buried with his ancestors in Jerusalem. As a kind of footnote, the book mentions a pool that the king builds, which is in fact an engineering marvel, allowing water to flow underground into Jerusalem, making the city considerably more siege-proof. The construction is all the more remarkable given that Jerusalem is built on top of a hill. Just when Judah needs to ramp up its credits with another responsible king, it gets the most godless ruler it has had since the monarchy began. Worse still, this inept clown reigns for a disastrous 55 years. The list of crimes against God committed by Manasseh of Judah rival those of Israel's king Ahab, who ruled around 200 years earlier, and he is likened by the writer to the heathen rulers to the north whose country is now yet another cog in the Assyrian machine. Manasseh not only rebuilds all the hilltop shrines destroyed by his father Hezekiah, he even creates new ones dedicated to the Canaanite gods Baal and Asherah, a feat of pagan zeal matched only by Israel's Ahab and his queen, the infamous Jezebel. Manasseh bows down to the stars and actually builds altars to other gods inside the Jerusalem temple. He consults mediums and spiritualists, possibly in the hope of contacting the dead, and even goes as far as sacrificing his own son in a fire. The king is such an aficionado of Canaanite religions that he practices divination and believes in omens, and it is no surprise that the writer believes God is furious at his latest king. Manasseh brings a carved Asherah pole into the temple which was built and dedicated solely to Israel's God. Despite God's ancient promise to protect the nation's borders so long as its people keep to the laws of Moses, no one is listening. Readers are told that Manasseh leads Judah astray to the point that God sees its people as even more evil than the Canaanite tribes who lived here before the Israelites arrived in the days of Joshua. The nation's prophets begin sharing what they believe God has told them. Disaster is coming. According to these holy men, God is about to deal with Jerusalem and Judah so dramatically that the ears of anyone who hears about this will ring. He will punish them in the same way that he ruined Ahab's family and later the whole northern kingdom of Israel. He will wipe Jerusalem clean like a dish, cancel his contract with his chosen people, and hand them over to their enemies. They will be looted and plundered and will become just one more Canaanite nation, cut free from any divine protection. According to the prophets, God sees his people as an ongoing problem that has infuriated him ever since he brought them out of Egypt. But Manasseh isn't listening. To even be mentioned in the same breath as Ahab should send alarm bells to the king, but it appears not to faze him. Social injustice and godlessness define his appalling rule. In the longest reign of any king of Israel or Judah, Manasseh sheds vast amounts of innocent blood while actively leading his people away from God. He builds nothing and wins no military victories. While David dances into Jerusalem at the head of a procession carrying the Ark of the Covenant, the sacred wooden chest containing the Ten Commandments, Manasseh simply sits on his throne like an Old Testament Jabba the Hutt, while his kingdom falls apart in a mess of his own making. Sources outside the Bible suggest that the king even executes the prophet Isaiah. In a final epitaph, Manasseh is not laid in the same tomb as the rest of Israel's kings. Perhaps he is not deemed worthy of such an esteemed resting place. Instead, he is buried in the garden of his palace, while control of Israel is given to his equally pagan son, Amon, a child named after the Egyptian sun god. Amon almost equals his father in his enthusiasm for pagan religion, and does well to survive infancy given Manasseh's penchant for sacrificing his own children. The Bible has a clear bias when it comes to kings of Israel and Judah and their belief systems. For the book's writers, kings are agents of God who they see as founding their nations and initiating the monarchy. Consequently, any king or queen who chooses a different god over capital G God is seen as both heretical and evil. To the Bible, Amon is an idol-worshipping goon, and the only way he might be seen as less evil than his father is that he doesn't actually build cultic shrines or desecrate Jerusalem's temple. To be fair to him, he simply follows the religion of his father, possibly seeing the devout faith in the God of David as a quaint belief from bygone times. Amon is murdered by a cohort of his own officials, but it appears that the king has won the approval of the populace, who seem sad and angry that he has been taken from them so soon. The conspirators who assassinated him are hunted down and killed, and for the second time in its history, a child is placed on the throne of Judah. Josiah is just 8 years old when his reign begins, and 47 years after the death of Hezekiah, Judah welcomes its final godly king. Too young to learn the bad habits of his father, Josiah becomes an uncharacteristically wise yet thoroughly welcome leader of Judah. Like Hezekiah before him, he is compared favourably to David by the writer, who is unable to fault him in his devotion to God. While he is still in his mid-20s, Josiah orders a refurbishment of the temple. Despite its transformation into a pagan shrine, or possibly because of it, money has continued to pour into the temple coffers. The king commissions foremen to hire carpenters, builders, and masons. as well as construction materials, all of which is to be paid for by money released from the temple coffers by Judah's current high priest, Hilkiah. Like Joash some two centuries before him, Josiah places such trust in his workers that no record needs to be kept of what is spent on the repairs. While work is underway, a document known as the Book of the Law is discovered by Hilkiah. This appears to be a written record of the laws laid down by Moses, which every king of Judah was duty-bound to read before assuming the throne. The fact that the book has been lost in the first place, and that Josiah and his officials appear to have no idea what it is when they are shown it, demonstrate how far the vibe has slipped in the 65 years since Hezekiah ruled. One of Josiah's senior advisors, a man named Shaphan, reads the law to the king, and Josiah is so moved that he tears his clothes. He realizes how far short Judah's kings have fallen and can only imagine the anger which God must feel because of their awful behavior. He immediately dispatches Hilkiah, Shaphan, and some other advisers to ask God about the book which they have found and what is written in it. The men find a prophetess named Huldah who is living in Jerusalem, who offers both bad news and good news. The bad news is that disaster is coming. Because the nation has abandoned him to worship foreign gods, God's anger will burn against Judah with an unquenchable fire. The Israelites themselves have become a curse and will be decimated, she says. The good news is that Josiah will be spared. His humble attitude and his faith have impressed God, and he will die peacefully before divine retribution visits his country. Encouraged by Huldah's words, Josiah gathers all of Judah's elders in the temple and makes a public promise to follow God's laws. Now that he has the ear of the people who run his country, Josiah reads from the Book of the Law. This is most likely the first five books of today's Bible, which is seen as a single unit known as the Pentateuch. This done, Josiah officially renews Israel's solemn promise to follow God and keep to his diktats, not for some arbitrary reason, but because they believe in them wholeheartedly. The leaders crammed into the temple add their own personal pledges to do likewise, after which Josiah sets about spring cleaning the temple, removing all pagan idols, destroying any religious items dedicated to other gods, and burning them in the Kidron Valley outside of Jerusalem, which by now has become a giant landfill site. As a final indignity to the gods, he carts the ashes off to Bethel, the pagan centre set up by Jeroboam I after Israel split with Judah, and which is possibly seen as the incubator for all idol worship in the region. Josiah sacks the pagan priests who his predecessors had appointed to serve at the high places and grinds down the Asherah pole placed in the temple by his grandfather Manasseh, scattering its dust on the graves of the people who worshipped Canaan's gods. He tears down the homes of the male shrine prostitutes and the workshops where women have been weaving temporary shelters for Asherah. The king and his priests destroy the cultic shrines that proliferate Judah, including some that have been set up at the gates of Jerusalem itself. To show how corrupted the Jewish religion has become, the priests serving at the high places are also employed by the temple, although they appear to have quite menial responsibilities. Josiah spoils the ritual site at Topheth, where pagan Israelites have been sacrificing their children to the god Molech. The traditional site of child sacrifice in Judah is a valley called Gehenna, and it is seen as so terrible that it gives its name to the final destination of the wicked and the damned, which many Bibles translate as hell. Josiah also removes horses which have been dedicated to sun worship from the entrance to the Jerusalem temple and has the accompanying chariots burned. After clearing pagan altars from the temple roof and those which Manasseh set up in the temple courts, Josiah throws the rubble with the rest of the city's detritus in the Kidron Valley. The purge continues as the shrines set up by Solomon for his foreign wives at the end of his reign are desecrated, their sacred stones smashed, their poles chopped down, and the site scattered with human bones, possibly those of the priests who served there. Not content to rid Judah from the presence of pagan worship, Josiah moves into the land formerly known as Israel and destroys the shrine at Bethel, where, centuries earlier, Jeroboam set up the golden calf which began his nation's descent into oblivion. The king raids the tombs on the hillside near the shrine and has their exhumed bones burned on the remains of Jeroboam's altar, desecrating it even further. 3.5 centuries earlier, a prophet promised Jeroboam that a king named Josiah would destroy the altar he had built in Bethel. When Josiah is told that a nearby tomb is the final resting place of the prophet who predicted his purge here, he orders it to be spared the fate of all the others, and also puts a protection order on the grave of the local prophet who tricked him. Feel free to backtrack to episode 80 to see how that particular story plays out. Continuing on into Israel's former capital, Samaria, Josiah clears away the Canaanite shrines, slaughtering the priests who served them and scattering their bones on their altars. Once he is satisfied that all worship sites that aren't dedicated to God have been eviscerated, the king returns to Jerusalem. Can Josiah's purge save Judah? As a new empire's power rises, will Josiah's sons have what it takes to ward off the powers of darkness that threaten their nation, their city, their temple, and their people? Or will the prophets be proven right? And will Judah go the same way as Israel before it, its monarchy dethroned, its buildings obliterated, and its population deported or killed? Keep listening as the second book of Kings reaches its dramatic season finale. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chaz Bayfield, with original music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. If you like what you're hearing, tell your friends and family, and if you're feeling especially generous, you can give me a star rating on whatever channel you're listening. You can send any comments or feedback to contact@holybible.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.